Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Good morning, America. Especially those of us in the Charlottesville, Albemarle listening area. Thanks for listening. It is Sunday morning. It is the Sunday morning wake-up call. Our guests today, Jeffrey Fogel, Walter Heineke. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Morning, Rick.
Thank you for being with us today. Our conversation, already in debate. We haven't even gotten started. I titled it Waning Democracy. Walt is an associate professor. Jeff Fogel, a Charlottesville attorney. Would you like to guess which one is debating the title? I grew up with an attorney as a father.
No hints there.
We are going to be talking about several different parts of how our American democracy is changing, some problems and how democracy is being altered, some Supreme Court decisions that have made that happen, how this is happening in the Charlottesville area with the dramatic increase in money that happened from the 2013 Democratic primary to the 2015 Democratic primary, some rules that went into place in the Charlottesville City Council back in February, and how not everyone was in agreement with that and believed that that is altering the ways that the general public can step up and make their feelings and thoughts known to the leaders of the city. So again, good morning, guests. Let's start with what many, maybe not all the guests here in the room, would say is a growing problem in many cities in the United States about a waning democracy. Walt, you pointed out to me that there is a Princeton study about this topic. Share that with us.
Yeah, so what got me going was these new rules in Charlottesville City Council about citizen input and the way that the city council operates. And I started to look around and say, you know, is this just a problem of Charlottesville, or is this a problem that's a greater problem in the United States with democracy? So I came across a 2014 study by a Princeton research team named Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page, who examined over a 20-year period the relationship of policy outcomes to public opinion. So in their analysis, they suggest that the majorities of the American public actually have little influence over the policies our government adopts. That policymaking is dominated by powerful business organizations and a small number of affluent Americans, and that America's claims to be being a democratic society are seriously threatened. The Gillens and Page study analyzed 1,700 policy outcomes over that 20-year period, and they concluded that economic elites and organized groups representing business interest have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while mass-based interest groups and average citizen have little or no independent influence. And I'm starting to see this happening in Charlottesville, you know, whether it's with these new rules that council is putting into place, or things like the decision for the William Taylor Plaza development, in which the Planning Commission made a decision to rein that project in, and there was a citizen petition with over 500 citizens signing it, and still the council overturned the Planning Commission. So it's looking to me like these problems that are happening nationally with waning democracy are really starting to play themselves out in Charlottesville.
Jeff, do you think... Well, first of all, you said out front before we stepped into the studio that you you disagreed with the title of the show. You weren't sure that Waning Democracy was even a good title for today's hour.
Well, I don't think it's accurate. I think this country has never been a democracy. If you look back to the founders, you're talking about the upper class, propertied white males. It was money that controlled politics in the inception of this country, and it's money that's controlled politics all through. The North didn't win the Civil War because it was morally correct. It won the Civil War because it was economically more powerful than the South, and it imposed its will on the South, and then came to a deal with the South: we'll back off as long as you join our elite. So I've never seen this country as being a bedrock of democracy. The people have never been able to exercise their true voice, and that the people we're given to vote for are people who have been vetted by the very class that runs this country, and that is the rich. Now, on a national level, of course, we're looking at major corporations. We're looking at the energy sector. We're looking at the financial sector. We're looking at the military-industrial complex. And on a local level, we're looking at developers. We're looking at the people who make the money in Charlottesville that makes Charlottesville such a so-called wonderful place. And so at every level of government we see, money talks, the rest of us walk.
So would you call it an increasing plutocracy?
No, I would call it an oligarchy in which some rules change and then change back and then change back. It's a never-ending struggle in this country to get people's real voices heard, or actually they're heard but enacted. As Walt just pointed out, the discrepancy between people's opinions and what the actual policies of the government is great. That disparity is huge. And I would suspect if you looked up for 200 years ago, it's less huge than it was 200 years ago, because women couldn't vote, black people couldn't vote, people who were not property couldn't vote. So I would argue that we're more of a democracy than we were 200 years ago. But we're not moving in the right direction, and it is still not a democracy. So when I say more of a democracy, you know, we're talking about incrementally.
Yeah, so I'd have to agree with Jeff. You know, this is part of a larger national trend in which money is starting to rule our democracy. For instance, the Citizen United decision and the McCutcheon versus FEC Supreme Court decisions are decisions in which big money has been allowed to control our elections. Now, what's the local application of that? Well, in the last Charlottesville city council election was the most expensive ever, with candidates spending large amounts of money. The winners all outspent the losers, by the way. In a Daily Progress article in 2016, Paul Long raised the issues with campaign money raised by Bellamy, Signer, and Galvin. According to a news release, Long took issue with some of the campaign money raised by Bellamy, Signer, and Galvin last year, particularly donations from prominent wealthy individuals, professional associations, and Virginia Realtors Association. According to the Virginia Public Access Project, a nonpartisan profit that collects campaign information, the trio, the three counselors that ran last time, as of their November 24th campaign fund disclosure deadline, raised nearly $100,000 in cash donations and in-kind contributions. Nearly half of that money, about $50,000, was reported by VPAP to have come from political, real estate, construction, and business sectors. That total included $10,000 that came from Signer's Political Action Committee, the New Dominion Project.
So, just a quick question, yeah. Just for a fact check. Mm-hmm. Didn't Dee Dee Smith actually raise the third most amount of money and then lose in the...
No, she came behind...
I thought she came behind... She came behind Bellamy and came behind...
Yeah, Signer. And behind Galvin.
Okay.
By a few $100s. It wasn't a whole lot.
I thought she was a little bit ahead of Galvin, but I
have those numbers somewhere.
But unimportant in the overall scheme of how much more money has been raised in 15 versus 13.
Right. So when all this money is being donated by residents, property owners, and entities that have not been directly engaged recently with city council, money from other sources intimately involved with the current city developments and proposals did make sizable donations. So there's a real question about whether or not, you know, money is starting to influence our own elections, and money is starting to influence decisions that are being made.
Well, let's go back and talk about...
I have a little different take on that, Rick.
Go ahead.
If I might. And I think a good example of this is Bernie Sanders, who ran against the wishes of the elite, or against the wishes of the elite to be elected. The Democratic Party, we now know, used a variety of means to block his popularity, but was able not to rely on big money, to small money. It can happen in this country. And so it's hard to say that there's a correlation between the amount of money that you're promised by big money interests and the outcome of the election. The outcome of the election is secured in a variety of ways by big money, and that includes their control of the media. It includes a history of brainwashing the American people, lying to them, deceiving them, holding back information, just as we found that the Democratic National Committee was doing. So I see it is possible with small amounts of money from ordinary citizens to get elected in a local area. I don't think you could do it on a national level because they won't let that happen. But in a local area, I still think it is possible, even though the ability to make changes in society is also limited by that fact as well.
I do have to correct myself, Rick. I'm looking at some numbers here, and you're right. As of the May election campaign deadline where everyone had to report, Dee Dee Smith had spent $6,691 to Kathy Galvin's $6,209. So you're right. There was a little bit of a discrepancy there.
Well, if we go back to this as a national issue, and whether we choose to title the show "Waning Democracy," "Increasing Oligarchy," there are issues that I don't believe they were actually brought under the Princeton study in terms of public opinion leading to not changing policy outcome. But I want to know your thoughts on whether or not these issues have a role in things not happening the way the public is asking them or shouting that they happen. Fewer people are voting, except maybe in the last handful of elections. But if we look at this over the last 40 years.
When you say fewer, how many fewer in percentages? 2%, 3%?
Let's say that it's 2%. Okay. Let's say that it's 20%. But it's certainly not, if you go to some national countries, 80% or 90% of the people are voting. If you have the vision in your head of the stained finger, if you go to even when some of our more well-represented voting national elections, we barely break 50% of our registered voters are voting.
And people win national elections here with 26% of the vote. And then claim a national mandate to do what they want to do.
They're claiming a national mandate when they get 50.4%.
They don't get 54%
they use
of the eligible voters.
They use the word, well, that's right.
They get 26% of the eligible voters.
They use the word mandate when they get 50.4% right. of the actual voting numbers. That's always true. Bothered me to use the word mandate.
Well, it's kind of a chicken and the egg problem, isn't it? If you know that your vote isn't going to affect anything, it's not going to affect the decision makers because they're being influenced by big money, why show up to the polls? I think we're having that problem in Charlottesville as well. There were very few people that turned out for that last city council election. City councilors get elected by very small margins of votes. To the extent to which they're representing the city's citizens' interests in Charlottesville, I question.
The national government has shut down 12 times in the past 35 years.
Some people have said that Harrison was the best president we
William
ever
Henry
had.
Harrison, William because Henry. He only lived like 4 months while in office.
And most of the time he took naps. So I'm not sure that the close down of the government, which has caused serious problems, has been the reason why we have continual problems in this country economically, socially, culturally, with foreign policy, and so on. To me, much of what goes on in Congress and in Washington is simply a game. To me, most of what goes on in elections is a show. It's a carnival. We have clowns running, and we have a carnival atmosphere, and it diverts people from attention to the real issues in the case. We all love, and I have to put myself in that position, listening to how crazy Donald Trump is. I love listening to it, but to what end? I prefer listening to Laurel and Hardy if I want my my comic relief, and a variety of other people. But I'm drawn to it because the media draws me to it because he's so outrageous. But these are all distractions. And the election as a carnival is a distraction for the American people in doing anything, organizing themselves, and perhaps building from the bottom up, as we're talking about here, because your best chance of gaining any power in this country, at least electoral power, is locally. And that apparently is where we have to start, since the national elections are so well controlled by the moneyed interests of corporate America.
Well, that's why I was really concerned about the last Charlottesville election. In that election, there was more money spent than ever before in an election. And it's just an alarming trend that money is starting to influence our local elections. It's never been like that. Now, the argument is that they used to have a caucus, and now they had a, what was it called, a firehouse primary. And that's more expensive to run. And, you see some counselors, who ran in that election saying, well, to compete, you had to spend a lot of money. I think it's an alarming trend in Charlottesville that this national issue is starting to play out here where people are relying on money. And where are they getting their money? Well, if you look at the Daily Progress coverage on this issue, they're getting their money from a lot of private corporate donors.
It is 11:16 here on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. A couple civil activists here in the studio today: Walter Heineke, Jeff Fogel.
I'm not always civil. Let me warn you.
Hang tight, because we might see just how civil things get here in the remainder of the hour, as we're talking about democracies, oligarchies, who might be in charge of what or not here. Hang tight with us today. It is a beautiful day outside, not quite as warm as it was on Thursday and Friday, but lots of sun. And here we are back on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Thank you so much for being with us today. Enjoy your Sunday. You are welcome to call in. I think Dan is out there with the phones. Be polite. 284-9470, 284-9470, although we have an awful lot of material to cover. Sit around and listen to our civil and non-civil guests, Jeffrey Fogel, a Charlottesville attorney, Walter Heineke, an associate professor. Gentlemen, we've mentioned several times the costs of money being spent. So the Charlottesville elections, you mentioned that in 2013, City Council Democratic primary candidates spent an average of $2,500. And that was for what was called a firehouse primary, right? The primary was all day in one space, and everybody, when you showed, you had to show up and be there at whatever time of day, I'll say 9 a.m., and you had to stay the whole day until it was determined who the candidates were, and then you could leave. And then at some point before 2015, Charlottesville changed their manner and method of determining the candidates to the one that is people are more familiar with out in the county and nationally, as has been done with our national presidential candidates, of everybody gets to go to their local school or fire station or wherever to vote. And you can go at any time during the day when it meets your opportunity to go, and you get to vote. But that has changed, and the June 2015 Democratic primary, the number average dollar spent soared to nearly $19,000. And the current gentleman who's the mayor of Charlottesville, Mr. Signer, spent over $40,000.
And came in third, I think.
Right, because Wes Bellamy came in first, correct? But he also spent, I think he spent over
Yeah.
He spent 20-some thousand dollars.
Yeah, he had 2,400 votes about, and Signer had 1,855.
So it's all because, well, that's not true. I shouldn't say that. It certainly has a lot to do with the method chosen. You can do that firehouse primary where everybody can go, but not everybody can participate because people don't have the whole day to spend locked up in a room, in a building, determining who's going to be your candidate.
Rick, can I point something out? The Democratic Party is a private...
Are you going to be civil?
Right now. Because this is a factual question, and I'm very civil when it comes to factual questions. The Democratic Party is a private organization. It can conduct its primary or other business the way any private organization can do it. So they can choose how they want to conduct their primary under the law. The last time around, they chose to participate in what was already a public primary, and so they didn't have to spend any extra money in order to do that. I've been to I don't remember exactly what year it was. It wasn't so long ago where I went to a Democratic primary vote where it was at the Burley School. You simply went, left your vote, and you could leave. I didn't see a problem with that. In fact, in a way, I like the idea that it's a private party because as a private party, they can set their own rules as to who can participate. And so, for example, the Democrats in this city claim that it is a second chance city for ex-prisoners, ex-felons, or ex-offenders, ex-people who have been in prison, who have been denied the right to vote. The Democratic Party chooses as a private organization. They can include those people that they claim to be so concerned about in the vote for their candidates. Obviously, those people who have not had their rights restored cannot vote in the general election because that's public. But in a private election, they can. So we don't know yet what method the Democratic Party is going to choose for this next primary. And I suspect it will not be in your local schoolhouse because there is no national primary connected with it. I'm hoping that, if anything, they will revert to at least the one instance that I recall in which one could go. Of course, one had to sign a pledge in order to vote in the Democratic Party that you would support the Democratic candidate regardless, something that many Democrats are happy that the Republican Party are not supporting, some of the Republican Party not supporting their candidate, but the Democrats insisted on that pledge, and that you agree with all of their principles. Now, in one of their principles, I disagreed with, and I went and I said so up front. I said, can I come in even though I disagree with this principle? Oh, yeah, you can come in. You can vote. But, you know, there were many people who might have looked at that same piece of paper I did and said, I don't agree with that principle. I'm not allowed to vote. And the Democratic Party makes very limited effort, particularly with respect to their own private primaries, to reach out to that part of the community that has not participated before, that has been deprived of any power and influence in this community. And it's no secret as to who that is. That is the second Charlottesville. Poor, primarily black, and I don't say exclusively black, but primarily black. And if you look at the demographics in Charlottesville and you look at the voting patterns, you will see those people do not participate in civic affairs and in elections, precisely because they have been cut out. And even when they have participated, as when Holly Edwards, a leading member of the African-American community, participated, she was unable to have any influence on that city council, which is why I think she didn't run again.
Yeah, I mean, just back, it's just simple. It just seems to me that this national problem about money in elections is starting to hit Charlottesville, and there's evidence of it now when we see increased amounts of money spent. And then, you know, I mean, you always have to follow the money. And, you know, D.D. Smith brought this up after the election, you know, follow the money and look where people are getting their money and look if there are economic interests which are starting to influence the way that these politicians do their work. And I think this is coming out in the whole debate that we're having right now over Charlottesville City Council's rules and public input rules and the way that they're doing business, that they want to have an efficient process. They want to have a professionalized process. They want democracy to be efficient. And the things that are driving these rules that they implemented in February of this year are things that are related to this sort of anti-democratic, you know, professionalized version of democracy. So it's starting to play out here. And I think these rules that we're, you know, that we're really talking about, I think Nancy Carpenter talked about them on this show yesterday, but Jeff and I probably want to talk a little bit more about them now. These rules that are being implemented are part of this sort of national problem of a professionalized, economically driven, elite-driven democracy.
We'll get into the rules in just a second, but Walt Heineke, associate professor. We also have Jeff Fogel here, who's a Charlottesville attorney. This is the Sunday morning wake-up call, 11:25 here on a beautiful Sunday in our wonderful area. You said, you gave us the phrase, you want democracy to be efficient. And, Jeff, I ask you this question in a, and I ask you to use the definition that the average person has in their head, right? I don't want you to use the definition of democracy as you gave us to start the show.
Or as Plato gave us.
Right. But is democracy meant to be efficient, or can it be efficient and neat?
Well, it could be, I think, if you took out the oligarchy, if it really was, as we like to believe, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. I'll accept that as a definition of democracy, because that's in our history. It is not any one of those things. If it were those things, and people felt an engagement civically, and we took out the power of corporate interests and other big money, people would get together on a base level, on a level of a local level, and work together, developing a consensus and moving ahead on the most important issues. We cannot have it as it stands now, where we have a divided country and we have a divided city. Now, with respect to the conditions under which we have to operate, it's virtually impossible to have an efficient government here because they're so at odds with the people. I sat through the last city council meeting, and I have to laugh at their concerns about efficiency. You know, the first hour was spent giving out awards to the Cub Scouts, to the Boy Scouts, to the Girl Scouts, to the whomever. I don't have objections to the city giving awards, but if they want to have an efficient government session and they're so concerned about time, why would you spend the first hour giving out awards and then another half hour making announcements? They should post those announcements in a variety of places. We want that information. But that doesn't lead to any kind of efficiency. The council rules are designed to preclude engagement between the public and the council. So it sounds like, you know, what the council really doesn't like is the FOIA law, the open meetings law. They would love to sit in private offices, as they do before each meeting, and make all of their decisions in private, come out and announce them, as they do with some issues, such as, who's the mayor? Oh, well, we had that discussion already, and we have decided who the mayor is before we come into the room. That's what happened in January, before they came into the room where they were supposed to decide who was the mayor. And so there was a motion. Oh, well, we all thought it was going to be an exciting process. Who makes a motion? I make a motion that Mike Signer be mayor. Any second? Three people raise their hands. Any discussion? No. Okay, let's take a vote. 5-0. Well, we then found out that they had all discussed it among themselves and made that decision beforehand.
Which is illegal, right?
Well, it violates the spirit. I'm about to write a letter to the advisory council set up by the government on FOIA to ask.
I thought you weren't allowed to have more than... I thought it was illegal to have more than a certain percentage of the group together with that when it wasn't in public. Or
they did not make that decision collectively at one time. They made that decision by talking to each other one at a time.
Like one each passes each other in the hallway and then goes into the room, and then another one passes the other one in the hallway.
A telephone call saying, listen, we got to do this, we got to do that. Oh, okay. Would you call so-and-so? Okay, so-and-so, listen. So-and-so just called me and told me that he or she's in support of this, and we really need to do...
Oh, sounds like a bunch of 10th grade girls.
Well, sorry,
10th grade girls.
This is exactly how Terry Sullivan, the president of the University of Virginia, was ousted by the Board of Visitors through a series of one-on-one conversations, you know, between individual board members. So it's the same principle. Same
principle. My wife is an assistant principal at a high school, and I'm sure that she's sitting there rolling her eyes going, God, so it sounds like my kids are better behaved than some of that.
I have a slightly different perspective. I think democracy is inefficient. It's always meant to be inefficient. It's slow. It depends on lots of different perspectives getting together and being hashed out. I think corporations are meant to be efficient. Corporations are not meant to be democratic, and they're not democratic. They're top-down organizations. And I think the city council right now, this majority on city council, is attempting to turn our democracy into an efficiency-based corporate model, and it just doesn't work. It never works. Democracy is meant to be slower than that to be effective.
And that was my sort of question, was that I would have thought that democracy would be inefficient in the middle, that coming to the consensus, that would be the inefficient part. And then when you have the people who were grumbling and mumbling because they didn't get what they wanted, some people would be okay because, all right, I'm satisfied, I didn't get everything that I wanted, but I understand that that's democracy. But there's always the people on the fringe who it was never close enough to what they wanted. Those were going to be the people who made everything else as inefficient as possible for the remainder of the group.
So I've been in Charlottesville for 20 years now, and I've been watching politics for at least 10 of those 20 years. And I noticed that we've had a series of a lot of high tension, high conflict debates over things in the past years, like the dam. Right? You remember the dam issue, the water issue?
You can pick anything. Right? We've had, it's well, the parkway.
Well,
it's the bypass.
Parkway,
it's the whatever.
You're exactly right. And during those debates, did we ever need to have these new rules that shut down debate or that increased efficiency? Did the mayors that were in power during those particular debates ever have these same problems of kicking people out of council meetings, or shutting them up, or trying to quell their free speech? I don't think so. Something happened after this last election when these three councilors were elected. Something significantly changed that caused this problem or created this problem of dissent, democracy, efficiency. I don't know what happened, but again, we're back to the issues of the larger national trends that are starting to pollute our own politics. So there's something that happened after this last election that made efficiency really important, and that made new rules for public input really important, new rules for the way that councilors spoke, limited
to 3 minutes.
Let's
talk about some of those. Yeah. I've sort of skimmed over it because yesterday there was a show yesterday on WPVC. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, despite what Jeff Fogel, however you would define it. And so I didn't want to spend too much time on the rules itself, but let's talk about some of the new rules that Charlottesville City Council has put into place. Public speakers. Well, so there are a limited number of public speakers. There's a lottery system.
They didn't change the number of public speakers that could come and speak. They changed the way that the public speakers came. They created a lottery system, so you had to sign up in advance. Then you were chosen in advance to say whether or not you could come and speak, right? And then there are, if there are extra spaces, that, you know, people can speak up to 12. So the number hasn't changed. That's really not the issue, except for the fact that the mayor, using some bogus statistics, argues that more people are now coming to speak at public comment, when Matt Talheim of NBC 29 just did an exhaustive review over about 5-6 years looking at video and found out that there's actually a decreasing number of people that are coming to speak at council. But Rick, here's the real big point for me. When it comes to the lottery system, and that's just one issue that happened that was changed in January. When it comes to the lottery system, in the past, people could come down and sign up in groups when there was a really hot issue and express the level of concern that they had on a particular issue. They can't do that anymore, right? Because they're lotteried out. They're separated out. So, you know, if the social justice community wanted to come down and make an issue about stop and frisk, they could get together, come down, sign up, and really let the public and the council know how strong their opinion were about this particular problem, right? They can't do that anymore because they've been lotteried out. Now, that, I think, was the purpose of the lottery system. I can't think of any other purpose than that, to sort of cull out the leadership of the sort of social justice organizations.
Maybe it's because you were cutting me out. Because there were so many people talking about stop and frisk, you didn't give me a chance to come and talk about my neighbor peeing, dog pooping on my lawn.
Sure, and there's always time at the end of meetings for that.
Yeah, but now I got to stay there until 12:30 in the morning because all the stop and frisk people are and making me stay up, and my dog wakes me up at 5:45.
That's true. Sometimes that did happen.
Making me stay up.
Sometimes that did happen, but does that outweigh the ability of citizens to sort of engage in collective dissent and come down to council together and, you know, make an issue?
But as Mr. Fogle would say, that's your opinion, not my opinion.
It is my opinion.
Rick, let me start off by saying that the examples that you've given of people who come to the city council concerned about the neighbor's dog peeing, the fire hydrant not being close enough to their house, the grass not being cut, there's not an adequate sidewalk. What that demonstrates to me is the failure of city government. It's inconceivable to me when we think on a national level that Congress would be the entity to go to when you had those concerns. You go to the staff that runs the city, which is run out of the city manager's office. Only if you cannot get relief in that setting, do you then go to the policy-making body? City Council does not run the city. It sets policy for the city. So that's a demonstration to me that the city is not working. But let me go beyond that and then tell you what my concerns here are. My concerns are that we're getting less engagement between the public and the council, and therefore less information to the general public about what the issues are and what the possible different positions could be. For example, in the past, council members had the opportunity and time set aside to respond to comments made by the public at that meeting. These were therefore relatively spontaneous responses to what had been raised. There is no responses allowed under the new rules by city council members. The responses are now provided by the city manager in a subsequent meeting. And I quote from their rules, as directed by the mayor. And so you have Mayor Signer, who wrote this rule, saying, I will determine what gets responded to, both in terms of quantity and in terms of quality. I will work with the city manager, tell him what to respond to and how to respond to it.
So whether I'm speaking about my neighbor's dog pooping in my yard or whether I'm talking about stop and frisk, no one on the city council is replying to my comment until there's some sort of reply written back to me. No one is replying to my comment then and there at the city council meeting.
Or at any time. Nobody's ever responded to the concerns I've raised about stop and frisk. It says here, and I quote, members of the council in general shall defer to the city manager's response to public comments and shall not respond to public comments as a whole. So councilors themselves have agreed to have their own free speech suppressed, along with those on the council that might disagree with them. And then let me go one step further here. In debate, and I'm quoting again from the council's rules, speakers shall be collegial in their language, shall avoid all reference to personalities, and shall never, and let me emphasize the word never, allude to the motives of council members. So if a council member knows that another council member has been bribed, and that's why that council member is taking that position, according to these rules, they are prohibited from saying that.
What is the punishment?
Well, that's unclear, and I'm very curious as to what they think the punishment could be. There was an effort on their part to censor one member, Bob Fenwick, because of some comments he made about I think the Belmont Bridge.
He was the one person who voted against those rules, correct?
And then, unfortunately, voted to use those rules to suppress free speech in one instance. But, yes, you're right. He was the one person who voted against it. And the reason he voted against it is because they wanted to censor him publicly. And I guess that's their first remedy, is let's embarrass them by censoring them. Now, this is amazing that you never allude to the motives of another council member. So what they're saying to us is, and I've used this analogy, this is very much like the Soviet Union. In what used to be called, do you remember what they called it? Everybody could have their discussion with themselves, but once you went out in public, there was only one voice. And that's the attitude of this council. Maybe we should be calling the Union of Soviet Charlottesville.
Well,
I'm not sure.
Let me just add to Jeff's point here. Matt Talheim, who's a reporter for NBC 29, did an exhaustive review of people speaking at council. He went back about 5 years and looked at video, so his numbers are good, right? So in 2013, he found that 27% of the meetings had fewer than 10 speakers. But in 2016, under these new rules for the public input lottery system, 50% of the meetings had fewer than 10 speakers. So in actuality, the new rules are causing less people to come, even if they're coming to talk about, garbage in their front yard or garbage in the street or whatever the issue is, there are fewer people coming to speak because of these rules. Now, so basically what the rules have done are two things. They've sort of cut out the dissent from major social justice group and groups of citizens that want to combine their speech to show the public how strong their opinions are about a particular issue. And they've cut out people who regular people from coming, which is the intended change for the rules. Lastly, Rick, I don't want us to get mired in just the public lottery system. In February, there were other significant changes that were made that Jeff's alluded to. One, the new rules limit the time any counselor could speak on an issue to 3 minutes. Two, they limited the entire time counsel could speak on any issue to, I think, 20 minutes. Now, what does this do? This drives public discussion into the back room, smoke-filled rooms, where things are being talked about and discussed, not in front of the public, but, in private, which is not democracy.
So what happens, and sorry, Walt, I don't want to, again, our guests today, Walt Heineke and Jeff Fogel, as we're talking about, now this seems like waning democracy, and we're talking about, currently we're talking about some of the new rules at Charlottesville City Council, or at least new back in February. What happens when the clock goes off at 20 minutes? We're talking about an issue that is going on at city council, and the buzzer goes off. What happens?
The council can extend it as they just did the other night.
Yeah, they can.
By a vote of the council.
Again, it's the discretion of the councilors. Two other things that we're not talking about yet. That are part of the new rules. The new rules allowed major and wide discretion to the mayor to determine what is appropriate speech is. Now, I don't know if you've been keeping track of who's for this and who's against it, but the Rutherford Institute for Free Speech came out and wrote a major letter objecting to this part of the changes to the rules. Right, the Daily Cav editorial staff has come out against it. Former mayors have come out against this. The other one is the other.
You missed one group.
I'm sorry.
The Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression here.
Yeah, just filed. Josh Wheeler will be back. We'll have this.
Josh just filed a brief in federal court challenging one of these rules on the face as violative of the First Amendment.
And there'll be a muggle against the.
No, let me just mention, because I really, the first case I took in Charlottesville was against the city for limiting the free speech rights of panhandlers. Took us 4.5 years to litigate that case. The city claimed that it was a necessary safety measure on the downtown mall. The judge, when he finally decided the case, concluded that the city had lied to the public and lied to the court about the reason for the imposition of that rule, that the real reason was to go after panhandlers, and in the course of which they had violated free speech. So I'm not surprised by much of anything the city does, but I am confident that they are capable and willing to lie and deceive about their purposes.
Guys, let me, it's 11:44. I need to take the second break. Folks, we are on the Sunday morning wake-up call. This is 94.7 WPVC. Our guests today, Jeff Fogel and Walt Heineke. We'll be right back. All right, it is late in the hour, but you're still welcome to call up 284-9470. Dan's out front waiting to take your call. If you have a question or a comment on the topic or for our guests today, Walt Heineke and Jeff Fogel. Walt, there was another rule. This was happened to be one of my favorite ones. Go ahead,
yeah.
Share this one.
So the sort of fifth rule, we've already talked about public comment procedures in the lottery system, but the fifth rule was the new procedures allow the mayor to turn off the cameras during dissent. Now, can you imagine turning off the cameras on the Pettus Bridge during the Civil Rights Movement and cutting off the public from seeing that? We wouldn't have that would have delayed the Civil Rights Act by probably years if people hadn't seen that.
Well, they get on police officers all the time if the camera goes off.
Yeah. Well, and let me add a couple more things that are happening. Now we're finding out that the council is peppering meetings with plainclothes policemen who are now present at the meetings and who are, you know, when somebody objects and the mayor says you're ejected, these plainclothes police officers are now getting up and starting to sort of escort people out. So there's one police officer in uniform, but now we're finding out that there's plainclothes police officers peppered in there ready to go when there's some kind of dissent. Now, what is that all about? That and the mayor's been throwing people out right and left or ejecting them. Some people argue that those ejections are themselves subject to racial bias. That certain that Anglos are not being ejected fully when they're being asked to stop speaking, but that perhaps African Americans are actually being ejected from the meeting. So there's some racial issues coming up with the ejections as well. So again, plainclothes police officers. Since when have we had plainclothes police officers peppered in our meetings? Is that not dissuading people from coming to meetings?
All right, guys, let's take a call and give me just a second. Caller, are you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, go ahead.
So, yes, the police officers do dissuade people from coming. In fact, my daughter and I have been coming for months, and since the last meeting in which there were plainclothes officers, she refused to come. So I'd like to just say that has really upset my family. But my question is now, where do we turn? I feel just as dismal as everyone else in this city. What do we do now? It's like there's a monster we've created. What do we do? That's where I want, because I know there's only a few minutes left. And that's what I'd like to know. What do we do now? I can't wait another year and 3 months. As Mike Signer said, I'm only up here another year and 3 months. That's too long for me. What do we do? Help us out.
All right, I'm going to let the way the board is tweaked. Can you listen on the radio for the answer?
Yes, I can. I'll turn up my phone now.
All right.
I'll hang up, okay?
Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.
Well, that's a problem. There is no provision in the city charter for recall, for example. If there were, that would certainly be an appropriate means to move ahead politically in removing Mr. Signer and anybody else from the council. And so I don't, frankly, think as a legal matter there's anything that can be done in the short run. I think the answer has to be building an alternative political operation in order to get the right people, or decent people at least, elected, who will not abide by the kind of authoritarian rule that Mr. Signer likes to impose.
There's a petition out you can sign. I think you can come down to city council and speak at it at public comment. You can send emails. You can call city councilors and complain about these rules. These rules have to be vacated. Now, one last thing. What I find really interesting is this is all a lot of hullabaloo about shutting down dissent. What's the dissent that they're trying to shut down? Why do they want to have a clean public meeting? Well, it's because let's get to the root of the cause of the dissent. What's causing these people to come to the to come and speak out and get ejected at meetings? The citizens of Charlottesville want an end to racially biased harassment in stop and frisk. They want to end disproportionate minority contact with juvenile justice system. Is there any evidence that the city's task force on this has produced any substantive result? Citizens want improved and increased public housing. They want an end to disproportionate discipline of minority students in our school. They want to stem gentrification in this town. These are the issues that are causing people to come and cause a ruckus at council. And rather than dealing with the cause of the problem, they're dealing with the symptoms, and they're trying to shut down dissent and free speech. Why don't we get back to the causes?
Yeah, I think it was one of the interesting comments that I thought the police chief made, and I certainly agree with him, is that if you want to bring down crime and violence, you can't look to the police to do that. You have to deal with the economic issues that exist within our community. And in a community that's so rich, to have so many poor people and such a disparity in wealth is outrageous. Now, when the chief said, we need to deal with poverty if you want to bring down crime, you know what the response of the council was? Oh, yeah, we know that. And then they'll do nothing about it. But they will hire 22 new police officers, as they're planning to do, at a cost to the city of $1 million a year to do bring down crime when their own police chief says that won't bring down crime.
We did get a call from Jerry. By the way, folks, it is 11:51, so there is time to still make a few calls here for our guests, Jeff Fogel and Walt Heineke. 284-9470. That's 284-9470. Dan is here to take the call on Sunday morning wake-up call. Jerry from City called and said, wants to know when the mayor got power rather than is just a ceremonial position. Either one of you know the answer to that?
Well, the mayor has always presided over the city council meetings, which is the only second function that he or she has, beside being the ceremonial head of state. So that's, at least as far as I know, existed for many, many years.
So this sounds more like a personality yes. power.
Precisely. I think it's the way he's exercised the power to run meetings that has gotten people's back up so much. I mean, there are many things about Mayor Hoosier I didn't agree with. Many, many substantive issues. But he did not try to act like an authoritarian in that setting. And he certainly gave breath to his fellow counselors, all of whom are equal, in making responses to the people and in saying what they felt they needed to say. So, again, we have a problem that the only people get elected to the city council are Democrats. The Democratic machine in the city has been very stultified and very narrow in terms of who they will select and to assure that those people do get elected. They were obviously upset when Bob Fenwick got elected, and that's the only deviation they've had in a while. But, you know, I just want to mention, we have not had somebody who grew up in Charlottesville elected to the city council since 1972. So the people from Charlottesville have been, who really are from Charlottesville, are no longer controlling the city. And of course, as an outsider myself who came here, I have no interest in controlling the city. I think it should be the people who have lived here their lives who should have the principal control over this city. And we also know from a study done by Harvard researchers that Charlottesville is one of the worst places in the United States for economic mobility. And what's interesting is it applies to the rich as well as the poor. Now, we're not going to feel too sorry if the children of the rich don't exceed their parents' expectations of richness. But we do have to be concerned about the fact that we are one of the worst places in the country. So say the Harvard researchers, based on their study, published in the New York Times and elsewhere, that upward mobility is virtually impossible to poor people in this community. And the Harvard researchers concluded the best thing that you can do if you have a child is to move out. And that may be part of the motives here. Let's get rid of some of these poor people. We're already pushing them out. 1,000 minorities have moved into the county because they can no longer live in the city.
Back to that the earlier caller. I think if council's not willing to listen to the public, you know, the Human Rights Commission came out against these rules. At the last public hearing about these rules, every speaker spoke against these rules. The Rutherford Institute's against these rules. The Cav Daily editorial staff's against these rules. There's lots of people against these rules. If they're not willing to change these rules and vacate these rules, which we ask them do right now, I think the caller should think about and listeners should think about the next election. Do we really want these kinds of people?
But JoJo said, and I believe that was the name. I apologize if I'm wrong. That's 15 months.
Yeah, right. So right now the issue has come down in protest to see if we can get them to vacate
the
rules.
So it's either embarrassment or wait.
Well, I mean, that's democracy.
That's great.
And Jeff Ogle's laughing because it's sort of like, lick your finger and hold it up saying, yep, that's where we were at the start of this hour.
That's why it's so perfect coming at the end of the hour.
I do want to mention one other thing about when this happened, the power of the mayor. We've never had mayors like this before. This particular mayor has written two interesting books, one on Madison, and Madison was very suspicious of the people and wanted to keep the people, the elites running the show and the people out. And he's written another book on demagogues, right, on demagoguery. Now, I wonder how much of the playbook he's now using when it comes to council meetings.
Maybe he got the spelling of that wrong. Maybe it was demagoguery.
56 here on the Wake Up Call. We could take one more call if somebody is out there stretching your fingers and so you don't pull a muscle while dialing the numbers. 284-9470. That's 284-9470.
Can I add? Let me say thank God for free speech in our country so that at least people like Walt and I and others can come on shows like yours, Rick, and speak our mind freely and say what we really believe. That is the thing that could save this country, is the belief in free speech.
You're welcome. So what I want to know is, go back to the national for just a moment. I want to know your thoughts on what Senator McCain said. He stepped back a little bit about how he was not going to allow the Senate to even, if Ms. Clinton was elected president, they were not going to approve any of her nominees for the Supreme Court.
Most outrageous sentence issued by a senator in the United States ever. Now, the Constitution requires that they consider and consent, and that is their obligation. It is not to obfuscate and not to prevent. The word prevent does not appear in the Constitution. Consent appears there. They can have a vigorous debate, as we've had on both sides of the aisle, regardless of who the president is, and then come up with an up or down vote. The Supreme Court just put aside or decertified some cases that they were going to take because they know they can't resolve them with an even number. And they have to have a fifth deciding vote, or rather a ninth person who would make a deciding fifth to four, where there was a fifth to five to four decision.
Because they stay the same. At four to four, it goes back to the lower level.
Well, it goes back, it reverts to whatever the lower court had decided.
Right. Yes.
It's basically affirming that lower court, only in that area of the country. So it does a disservice to the nation when we don't have rules that have been vetted by the Supreme Court, which is precisely how the Founding Fathers designed this country.
But what happens if Ruth Bader Ginsburg retires? So now we're down to seven. So now is that an effective Supreme Court? Now we can have 4-3 votes?
My sense is that, look, democracy is broken in the United States, and we talked about the reasons why earlier. My real concern at this point is, let's not let democracy get broken in Charlottesville. Like, there's only so much you can do at the national level, right? There's a lot you can do at the local level to create a strong, solid democracy. And I think it's up to the people of Charlottesville to figure out what kind of democracy they want to have.
On the one hand, we have Donald Trump saying if he's elected, he'll put Hillary in jail. On the other hand, we have McCain saying if she's elected, we will not allow her to fulfill one of her constitutional functions.
It's broken.
It's an amazing country.
Our Supreme Court will soon be a panel of five if Hillary Clinton is elected, because there's the presumption that one, two, or possibly three Supreme Court justices will retire over the next 4 years. So
these people don't represent the interests of the public.
Will the two of you come back sometime in the future?
Sure, now that I know where it is.
Absolutely.
That's what we need, is we need a big sign for not the dumpster side of the building, but the front side of the building. Jeffrey Fogel is Charlottesville attorney, Walter Heineke, and an associate professor here in town. Thank you so much for coming on the air.
Thanks,
Rick.
Next week, Sean McCord will be here going forward about the Virginia Film Festival. Thank you so much.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.